Let's go today to Daniel chapter 6. Book of Daniel chapter 6. In chapter 2, Daniel has had the vision of the image with the gold head, which was the kingdom of Babylon, followed by the silver chest, which is Persia, and chapter 5 and 6 mark the defeat of Babylon and the rise of Persia. So that really, chapter 5, verse 31, belongs with chapter 6. Babylon has fallen, Persia is the world power, and we have in verse 31, or 30 and 31, verse 30 is the end of Babylon, when it reads, "That same night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain." And in 536 B.C., that marks the end of the Babylonian kingdom. And in verse 31, we begin with Persia. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. And it seemed good to Darius. See how verse 31 fits in with chapter 6 very, very neatly. Keep in mind, and it's a good point to make at this point, that chapter division and versification mean nothing. The only thing on a positive way is it makes it possible to find sentences or fragments of sentences easily. Outside of that, whenever you read the Bible, mark out all chapter and verse divisions because they're very, very arbitrary. The versification was put in by a man named Stevens, and he was a circuit rider. And the common explanation for the versification of the Bible is that he struck off a new verse every time the horse stumbled. And therefore, if the horse was going fast, with every beat, he'd put in a new verse. And if it was going slow, you got big fat verses. But versification means nothing. And here's a good example. Chapter 531, the Persian kingdom begins. And for some reason, we have a chapter division. And then after the remark about Darius the Mede taking over, then you have entry into the into his plans. But actually, 531 goes with chapter 6. Now, as we go down the kingdoms, and remember the way they mark off, is they are kingdoms beginning in 606 B.C. with the kingdom of Babylon, and they go clear down to the return of Christ. And they are four. Number one, of course, was Babylon. That was marked off in chapter 2 by the head of gold in the image, followed by Medo-Persia. And, of course, these follow historically also. Followed by the third kingdom, which is Greece. Then followed by Rome. And then followed by Christ's return, and what we could call the fifth kingdom, or God's rule on earth. And what we're going to see in going through the kingdom is that they are called, all total, by Jesus in Luke chapter 24, 21, the times of the Gentiles. And the times of the Gentiles is marked off by the sudden intervention at the return of Christ and the establishment of his kingdom on earth. So that, as we have historically seen, the rise of Babylon, the fall of Babylon, the rise and fall of Persia and Greece and Rome, so in the last times, and I'll put a heavy X down here at the last, we will have what the Bible talks about as a revived Roman Empire, and this will be the period of time just before the return of Christ. The book of Daniel lays the basic groundwork for history, and it emphasizes in particular what will happen just before the return of Christ on that particular period. Then that is all expanded in great detail in the book of Revelation. And incidentally, as soon as we finish the book of Daniel, we will start the book of Revelation in the New Testament. It's been about 11 years since we've looked at the book of Revelation, and it will be the book that will follow the book of Daniel because it ties in to this book. Daniel lays the foundation, which the book of Revelation expands, And we'll see in our study today somewhere, either this session, the next one, or the next one, how the book of Revelation expands so many things in the book of Daniel, and therefore this is foundation for prophecy that is yet to come. Now, all of these nations, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, all have four basic features. And we will see it repeated in Persia, the same thing that was true in the kingdom of Babylon, and it will become much, much more intense just before the return of Christ. All of the kingdoms focus on man. And so the first point in every one is deification of man. Now, we could say that about Babylon and not have anything to show that that happened also in the next kingdom. But now we're at a point where we can go from seeing this in Babylon, then we'll be able to see it in Medo-Persia, and then we will be able to see it prophetically in the time before Christ's return. All human kingdoms center on man and basically deify man. Compare, for example, chapter 3, verse 1, kingdom of Babylon, and chapter 6, verse 7, the kingdom of Persia, going back to 3:1, and in these points we'll be comparing the two kingdoms. 3:1, Nebuchadnezzar, who was king of Babylon, the king made an image of gold. And remember, that keys off of chapter 2, because in chapter 2 you had a succession of world kingdoms, and Babylon was only the head of gold, not the rest of the body. Nebuchadnezzar has an ego trip, and he makes the entire image gold, meaning himself. And the height of it was 60 cubits and 6 cubits, and he had it set up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And as the context follows, it is dedicated, the trumpets sound, and everybody is to bow and to worship Babylon, worship the king. Deification of man is the emphasis. Chapter 6 and verse 7. Same principle. It says, all the commissioners of the kingdom, and this is Persia now, not Babylon, the prefects, satraps, high officials, governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. And notice that is an obvious deification of man. It was true in Babylon, represented by the image. It was true in Persia, represented by the decree. Deification of man is the first characteristic always in these kingdoms leading up to the return of Christ. The second is, either you worship man or die. Point two, rule by force. We ought to put in deadly force. Rule by deadly force. Second characteristics of kingdoms up until the return of Christ. Chapter 3, verse 6, which tells how in this kingdom you must relate to the deification of man. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. Chapter 6, and we've already read verse 7, the last word, who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days, shall be cast into the lion's den. So in chapter 3, in the kingdom of Babylon, it was the fiery furnace. And in the kingdom of Persia, it is going to be the lion's den. Rule by deadly force. Worship man or die. Third point. In each kingdom, there is a great attempt at internationalism. Everybody worshiping the same way. In chapter 3, it's found in verse 4, the command to worship the image says, the herald loudly proclaimed, to you the command is given, O peoples, nations, men of every language. And then in chapter 6, it is found in verse 12 in Persia. After the petition to worship or not ask of any god except the king, it says, then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast to the lion's den? The king answered and said, and the statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Internationalism, 6:12. Fourth characteristic of the time between Babylon and the return of Christ will be, point four, believers in the minority. Believers in the minority. And in chapter 3, that of course was everybody bowed down except Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Three men, obviously a minority. And in chapter 6, the minority will be Daniel, who refuses to give up his petitioning of God in the interest of the king. Those four things are true of world powers. Now, when we come down to the time just before the return of Christ, these three things will be true. We will have the rise of what the Bible calls the beast. And the beast has the number of 666. No man can buy or purchase or do anything unless he has the mark of the beast, and everyone must do it and worship him or die. Deification of man. Rule by deadly force, again, the ability to take life. Internationalism, everyone must have the mark of the beast, and of course, believers will be in the minority. This is the pattern throughout Gentile government, and this we will see increased and stepped up in the time just before the return of Christ. And we will see when we get to the book of Revelation, it will be shot through with all of these things. Deification of man, anyone that knows anything, just a little bit about biblical prophecy, knows about the Antichrist. And I will never be able to say the word Antichrist without remembering being 6, 7 years old and hearing the preacher talk about the Antichrist. And what would a 6 or 7 year old take the Antichrist to be? The ant, A-U-N, of Christ. Aunt of Christ. And I thought he was talking about Christ's aunt. But nonetheless, anyone who knows even a little bit about biblical prophecy knows there is this great, powerful, you can call him the beast, you can call him the Antichrist. I think the best expression is the great world dictator that will arise before the return of Christ and will rule by deadly force, and everyone must be involved having the number of 666, the number of the beast, or die. And believers obviously will be in a minority. And believers not only will be in the minority, but they will suffer intensely for their faith. The book of Revelation, then, will reveal the final form that will follow this particular particular pattern. All right, now, the next thing, again, before we get into chapter 6 to note, is this, is compare 6 and 7. Now, it's true that versification is arbitrary, but do notice that chapter 6 contains 28 verses, and chapter 7 contains 28 verses. And it's interesting in the light of the fact that chapter 6 is as big as chapter 7 to then note what is the content of each chapter. The content of chapter 6 is merely a narration of how one man was faithful to God. Chapter 7 is probably the key chapter in the Bible, certainly in the Old Testament, that traces world history from the time of Babylon to the return of Christ. So the content of each is chapter 6, a man faithful to God. Chapter 7 is a panoramic view of all of world history. Question. Putting the two side by side, what seems to be the biggest and the most dramatic? One man who was faithful to God, or the whole scope of all of human history? Well, it's interesting that God gives equal treatment to both. And I think a principle comes off of that, which is simply saying this. the faithfulness of one man, Daniel chapter 6, to the Lord is as important to God as the whole panorama of human history. And God says, I will give as much time to my faithful Daniel as I will give to the whole scope of human history. And that emphasizes what is certainly a principle of Scripture, that faithfulness to God is tremendously important. In other words, God gives as much space in His Word to the faithfulness of Daniel as He does to the whole narrative of human history. It gives a little sense of what is important from God's standpoint. All right, now we'll take this chapter and break it down into four parts. It all revolves about Daniel. In part one, we'll look at Daniel. Every point will begin with Daniel and certain aspect of his life. Daniel, first of all, exalted. We will have that. And envied. Exalted, envied. And under that, first of all, take a look at his promotion. Daniel, exalted and envied, is chapter 6, 1 through 9. First nine verses, look at this man arising to a great position in the kingdom, and in that position, he is going to be intensely envied. And we will have some very, very important and interesting lessons on the characteristics of jealousy, the characteristics of envy, and how Daniel, and I think I could say at this point, probably if I had to say, what do you think is the greatest capacity that Daniel had? The greatest capacity that Daniel had was the capacity not to pay any attention to certain things. We'll get that through the whole book. The boys in chapter 3 didn't pay any attention to the fiery furnace. Daniel in chapter 6 won't pay any attention to the fiery furnace. One of the great characteristics of Daniel was the capacity to ignore, the capacity to just completely overlook something, no matter what it was, and not let it bother him at all. And we'll develop that and see it developed in chapter 6. But he is going to be envied. His promotion is narrated in 6, 1 through 3. And that, in turn, we will break down into two things that occur as he is promoted. First of all, a focus on his responsibility. And then the second point will be his distinction, how he distinguishes himself. His responsibility, 6, 1 and 2. Beginning in verse 1. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps. And since we don't use the word satrap very much or at all in English, roughly equivalent to a governor. The kingdom of Persia was divided to 120 districts, and over each district was a ruler. That would be roughly parallel to the United States. A governor of Kansas, governor of Missouri, governor of Nebraska, Iowa, and so forth. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 governors over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one. So notice the government structure, the king at the top, three commissioners, of which Daniel was one, and then the 120 underneath them. And the purpose of this is that these satraps or governors might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. What all that says is that as he took the kingdom, there was lots of corruption around. And there was lots of pilfering of the king's treasury and the king's funds. And Darius says, we've got to put a stop to it. So I'm going to have these 120 governors supervised by three men. And Daniel is one of them. And we find in verse 3 that Daniel was so good at his job that he got elevated and exalted to number one over the three kings. So it would be the king, then Daniel, then the other two presidents, then the 120 satraps over which Daniel was the in an enormously high position. So the responsibility would be second in the kingdom, or second to the king, And the purpose is to prevent corruption. And of course, they're talking of the king's suffering loss, obviously, is material loss, pilfering of the king's goods. All right, that is the position, then, that Daniel, of responsibility that he has. Now, in that position, you have an emphasis on his distinction. And that is in 6:3. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners. If you are in politics, how do you distinguish yourself? How do you get up the ladder? If you're in business, how do you distinguish yourself? Well, it's interesting the way Daniel did it, reading verse 3. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself. He did that by talking about himself, saying, look at me. I'm Daniel the Great, along with Darius the Great. No, he began distinguishing himself. I think it's very interesting that all the kings have to have, and you have it not only in the Bible but historically, something with their name to emphasize how good they were. Alexander the Great. It's interesting that of the men that really distinguished themselves as far as God is concerned, you don't read anything about Abraham the Great or David the Great. You don't need to. True greatness displays itself, and notice, again reading verse 3, here's the way it does it. Daniel began distinguishing himself among his commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. All right, the distinction was by means of his inner character, of inner life. Daniel was great because he was really great. He was great because of what is on the inside. Go back and far as chapter 4, and notice this was always the thing that distinguished Daniel, was his inner life. Look at two places. In Babylon, under Belshazzar, Belshazzar saw something in Daniel, and it's recorded in verse 8. It says, but Daniel finally came in before me, whose name is Belshazzar, according to the name of thy God, in whom is a spirit, and remember the way we've suggested translating, is that the word gods can just as accurately be translated God, and I take it this is what he's saying, in whom is a spirit of the holy God. What did Belshazzar see in Daniel? An inner spirit of God. You go over to chapter 5 and verse 11, and you have a remark by the queen. And when the queen remembered Daniel, she remembered him for a certain thing. Chapter 5, verse 11. The handwriting on the wall has appeared. The king is enormously afraid. The queen comes in and says, don't be afraid, don't let your face be pale. And verse 11, there is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy God. Notice emphasis, and this is the first thing she mentioned about Daniel, is his inner spirit. And you come to chapter 6 and verse 3, noting that he possessed an extraordinary spirit. Daniel had an enormous quality, and he had the ability to submit all of the details of life to the Lord. Ability to submit details of life to God. And those who observed him saw that. Whether or not they, and I'm sure when they say there's a spirit of God in him, they're not, that doesn't come out of the fact that they had an understanding of the Trinity and the Holy Spirit and so forth. It just means we can't name it, but we can see it. We know that there's something inside of Daniel that is unique, and it is something that we can see. Basically, when you see in chapter 6, verse 3, the words extraordinary spirit, you might just put after that P.S., postscript, because that's all the rest of the chapter is. All of the narrative of the king's decree, the throwing him in the lion's den, his rescue out of it, it's all postscript. So really, chapter 6 is all over with the words extraordinary spirit, because all we're going to get to see from here on is a little bit of the details of how his spirit was truly an extraordinary spirit in the fullest sense of the words. That's his promotion, where he is in the kingdom, his inner life is together, that's all that counts. Now, that follows with his opposition, or his opponents. Really, we could put it this way. Chapter 6, 1 through 3, Daniel. Daniel 6, 4 and following, everybody else. God's people are always in the minority in the times of the Gentiles. Chapter 6, verse 4. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was found to be in him. So notice you have the rise of the opponents who are envious of Daniel. Remarkable statement. I suppose Daniel stood in the way of their ambitions. In verse 2, the organization of the kingdom was so the king wouldn't get pilfered anymore. And I'm sure Daniel came in and he set things up so that couldn't happen. And to the rest of the government officials, that got in the way of their ambitions, and they opposed Daniel. So his opponents, verse 4. Verse 5 focuses on his testimony. And I know if I had to turn anywhere in Scripture to say, where can you find a better testimony to a man's integrity, then Daniel 6:5 probably has to be it. If we had opponents, let's suppose, just take our job. If one of your fellow workers wanted to find a fault in the way you carried on your job, could they find one? Would they say, I'm sorry, there is no fault there? Well, that happened with Daniel. If you would sit with me for one day, and I did my best, you would find fault, legitimate fault. And don't look pious. If I worked with you for one day, you did your very best, I could find fault too, legitimate fault. But it's interesting, as badly as they want to find fault with Daniel, verse 5 reads, then these men said, that's after trying to find fault, we shall not find any ground of accusation against Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of God. The only thing they could say is this: he is faithful to his job and his God. And the only thing that we can resort to is to make his devotion to God clash with his job. And as of now, it doesn't do it, but we are going to concoct something that we will. Very important point in verse 5 about jealousy. Jealousy is never satisfied. Jealousy never gets what it wants. If jealousy cannot find a fault, it will create a fault. And that's important because that's the springboard into the following. If jealousy is one of the most insidious sins possible. If jealousy cannot find a fault, it creates a fault. If it cannot find a fault, it creates a fault. And that is a very important principle. Because up through Daniel 6:5, their jealousy is saying, we can't find any fault with Daniel, but we're jealous. And it doesn't make any difference if we can't find a fault. we're going to create one. And basically, verses 6 and following is going to be the creation of a fault. And I would say at the end of verse 5, when even his bitter enemies could find no legitimate fault, what a testimony on the part of Daniel. All right? This moves then to our fourth point, his test. His promotion, 1 through 3. His opponents, verse 4. His testimony, verse 5. His test, 6, 6 through 9. And the test revolves about, number 1, the conspirators. Nothing can be done about jealousy. If you're in a position where someone is jealous of what you're doing, you can't talk it over. That won't work. Jealousy is never satisfied. You can't work it out. All you can do is maintain fellowship with God throughout it and suffer at the hands of jealousy, because that's the nature of jealousy. Now, there are five things we can say about the conspirators. Number 1, they were schemers. Now, their scheme was something like this. We can't get Daniel on legitimate grounds, so we're going to have to concoct something. We're going to have to scheme. And the thought was probably something like this. Someone came along and suggested that, well, you know something about the king? The king has got a real big ego, and I think if we take advantage of the king's ego, we can nail Daniel. Let's do this. Let's suggest to the king that for 30 days, nobody can make a petition of any god except him. King will love it. King will love it. And if someone does so, then we will put the death penalty with it. Now, this was all a scheme to get Daniel. And what, again, does that say about Daniel's testimony? What did these guys know was going to work? They knew something about the king, is that he's got an ego. But did they know something about Daniel when they concocted this scheme? Do you concoct schemes that you know won't work? You bring up schemes you know will work. How did they know it would work? Because the king had an ego and Daniel was faithful. And they knew good and well Daniel would not respond to this. This is the devotion to God that Daniel had established in front of these men. They were schemers. Second thing we can say about them is they were liars. Read verse 6 and see if you can pick that up. 6 and 7. Verse 6, then these commissioners and governors came by agreement to the king. We might also say jealous people are also cowards. They came by agreement. Nobody stepped forward. They came as a group. They came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. What's the next word? All the commissioners. Who was Daniel? Daniel was one of them. And they said, all of the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, the governments, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. You think Daniel was part of that meeting? Of course not. They are liars. When they say all of the commissioners, they mean 2 out of 3. But they're trying to tell the king that the Daniel is part of this. And, of course, they are just simply plain, flat lying. Another interesting lesson. Do you think the king believed that Daniel was part of this scheme? Ask of no one except me. He knew better than that. It's interesting, isn't it? Ego is bigger than good sense. Ego doesn't even listen to logic. And the king is so impressed with himself that he knew good and well that Daniel would not be part of this, but he buys their line. Ego buys anything that bolsters ego. Ego buys anything that bolsters ego. Later on, the king regretted what he did badly. Couldn't sleep all night. And he had no food, no fun, and no sleep. And that's exactly what the text is going to say. No food, no fun, no sleep. But ego makes a fool of a person. And this is what happens to him. He buys the line because it basically bolsters his ego. All right, schemers, liars, number three. They were united. They schemed. They were united. Emphasis on all the commissioners. They did this thing all together. Very important thing we have used earlier, the expression that I think sticks. They were those people who were the victims or who were thinking in terms of herd mentality. Think of them as the mooing herd. There's something always true of the mooing herd. The mooing herd always does something A, stupid, or something B, evil, or usually both. And they are going to do something that is both stupid and evil in context. But they are united together. They're exhibiting herd mentality. Third, they were hypocrites. Now, ostensibly, what was this plan to do? Ostensibly, the plan was to honor the authority of the king and have everybody bow to him and honor the king. That's the way they came on. King, we want to honor you. We want to make it so that nobody is worshipped except you. Was that their real motive? Can you remember it this way? Honor the king was the motto. Nail Daniel was the motive. Jealousy is always hypocritical. Honorable programs, and this was honorable as far as the king was concerned, do not mean honorable motives. Jealousy knows no honor. Self-ambition observes no principle, and ego observes no rules. Fifth, they were vicious. They would settle for nothing less than death. They wanted Daniel torn limb from limb, literally. Final principle. Faithfulness to one's job, devotion to God, and notice the word I'm going to use, not may, not can, but will create enemies of the most vicious variety. And that's what happened to Daniel. Didn't Jesus say this? The world is going to what you? Dislike you. Get hacked off with you. Be disturbed by you. The world will hate you. And Daniel is faithful to the Lord, and the world in which he lived hated Daniel. And this is what he is coming up against. And at this point, and I've felt this several times in Daniel, you see the way this guy seems so undisturbed, you want to go up and shake Daniel and say, Daniel, stupid, you're in big trouble. This is bad stuff. But Daniel isn't trouble. He's going to have a good night's sleep next to Leo the lion, who has lockjaw. Father, we're thankful for your word and your truth. We're thankful for the faithfulness of this man. May we learn that really the single issue of life is maintenance of fellowship with you, and that's all that counts. For this we give you thanks in Christ's name.